All right. So if you didn't, there's some handouts on the gray stand back there. Open to the book of Daniel. We'll actually start looking at Daniel 4, a passage there. The book of Daniel, especially for the last, say, 75 years, has caused no small amount of confusion and dissent. I mean, since its writing, so whatever, 2,600 years, it's caused no amount of confusion and dissension. But especially in the last, say, 75 years or so, because the book of Daniel contains a whole bunch of what we would call apocalyptic literature. How many people have heard at least a little bit of the Revelation study that Tony did this summer? So a few of you were there. Revelation is another book that is written in apocalyptic literature. So we basically have a little bit of Ezekiel, Daniel, and the book of Revelation, and that's most of our apocalyptic literature. But from about 200 BC to 280, all sorts of things are written with visions and trying to tell story and these horrific beasts kind of pictures coming out of seas and all of these kinds of things. So it's strange to us because for the most part we kind of read our Bible over and over, but there's a period of time in which writing this way is really common. Now, Daniel's written before that. There's some, obviously, that comes before that. But I'm just trying to say that there's a sense in which some people look at it and go, oh, sci-fi, I got it, great. But it's common as can be. And so some of the images that we read about in Daniel are actually things that have general meanings. That doesn't mean we can precisely knock down all sorts of specifics as we go through the book of Daniel, but it means that there is a way of reading. So we don't have these anymore. They're called newspapers. But you order your newspaper and you don't have any problem as you turn page to page and understanding the different kinds of ways that you need to interpret what's being given to you. So the front page is full of these articles that are reporting, right? And you're like, okay, news briefs, da, 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 da. You read the headline, kind of get the gist, go on. You flip the page and it's editorials on the backside. It's okay, this is someone's opinion, he's trying to reason. And you start to engage in a different kind of way. You flip over to the comics and you don't take, you know, Calvin and Hobbes as the same thing that was on the front page. You know, Peanuts is not trying to get across the same message. Well, I shouldn't say it. Peanuts is not trying to convey the information in the same way. It may be actually talking about the same thing or the same message or you might get a political cartoon that's making the same point that the editorial just did, but it comes in a whole different kind of way. That's what we're dealing with apocalyptic. Not a all terribly strange way to talk, though what's in it is plenty strange. Does that make sense? All right, so Let's actually dive into some of the history just to help you kind of set the pace. So Tony has written this up on the board before, but there were three different exiles or times when the Babylonians came to the southern kingdom, to Judah, and pulled people and resources out of it. So we're talking the northern kingdom is long gone. It's been destroyed by the Assyrians. They're scattered throughout. Only the southern kingdom and the kingdom of David is left. The first time is in 605 BC. Okay, and this is actually when Daniel is taken. So a whole bunch of the book of Daniel has these kind of little time markers. In the year of this king, in the year of this king, in the year of this king. And so he tells us right in the whole, at the beginning of the book, that in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. So that matches up with 605 BC. Now after that, in 597, and then finally in 586, the Babylonians come back and each time take a little bit more away until in 586, they wipe Jerusalem off the map. So Daniel is already in Babylon. He's already traversed the 600 miles going up and around and down into Babylon, probably long before even the second exile has happened. So he is there. He is reading about the exile. He's actually, when we get to chapter nine, he's actually got fresh off the presses a copy of Jeremiah that he's reading. Right? And so Jeremiah tells the story of, the theme of Jeremiah is the Babylonians are coming. The Babylonians are coming, warning over and over again. So even by the time that sometime after the exile or whatever, Jeremiah has been copied and sent to him, and he has even have a copy to meditate on and to read. So this is just, I'm just trying to give you a timeline so you can kind of figure out where we're at. 539 BC is up here because that's the year that Cyrus, no longer the Babylonian, but the king of the Medes and the Persians, gives his declaration that it's time for the exiles to go home. So it's the first time that there's a declaration at all, and the exiles are beginning to be sent home now. So many little pockets, groups from around Babylon kind of gather together, and they head back to Jerusalem. So that begins the return from exile that God had promised them. Okay, and then years and years after that, Ezra, the book of Ezra, which I think we'll talk about in a couple of weeks, mentions a couple of things happening. Ezra 7 mentions that in 457 BC, the temple is finished. So there's kind of a, things are put in place for worship to actually begin. And then, of course, some of the outside walls are finished then in 444, which Ezra mentions. And then down to the very end, this is going to have a huge impact on what Daniel's visions are and what scares him to death so much. Is this name from the Greek Empire, Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes, laid waste to Jerusalem and was hungry to devour the Israelites. So his name's going to pop up in a second. So there's kind of the general timeline of what we're working. And so these are the kingdoms that Daniel is talking about. We're going to mention a couple of visions here in a second, but one of them relates to Babylon. And then the one that follows, the Medes and the Persians. So the Persian Empire is sometimes what it's called by itself, but it's actually a conglomerate of two different kingdoms. There's the Greek kingdom, which obviously was started with Alexander the Great and his conquest of the world. And then eventually, I think that most likely there's a few portions that mention the Roman Empire toward the end. There's something that seems to be different, a stop, and then kind of moving on. It doesn't have a huge impact in the book, but it seems to be what Daniel is talking about. All right, so timeline. Now, step back a second, and here's how the book is actually broken down. So you've got one outline on the back, and this seems to be very much the case that almost every commentator that I looked at sees that there's some kind of flow that's happening within the book of Daniel. There's something about, there's these four kingdoms that are portrayed first in chapter 2 in Nebuchadnezzar's and then in chapter 7. And then as you work back, there's kind of right in the middle, there's two judgments that happen against, the last two kings of Babylon. So there's something of this movement in and then back out. So I went ahead and left that outline on there, but that seems to be how the book is actually flowing. Another way to look at the book is it's simply almost broken half perfectly, where you've got six chapters that tell stories, and then you've got four visions that are described in the last half of the book. Now, the reason that matters is because when you get to the visions, how do you know that Daniel is a trustworthy interpreter of the visions? How do you know that he has the kind of insight that chapter 1 describes, that he's able to bring these things to bear where he's at? Well, it's because you've read him give an interpretation without any info in chapter 2. You've heard him now be described by the time that they get to after Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 5, he's suddenly even able to called back by Nebuchadnezzar's wife, is able to call back and say, hey, this guy has always interpreted dreams faithfully. There's this kind of whole picture of him that he's been this faithful interpreter of everything along the way. So you can trust then what he writes in these last chapters. All right. So there's the overview. Let's jump in by starting with those judgment pictures against Nebuchadnezzar and his successor in chapters 4 and 5. So turn to Daniel 4. So Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Daniel starts to interpret it in verse 19. So let's read a few verses there. Chapter 4, verses 19. Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, this is his Babylon name, was dismayed for a while. His thoughts alarmed him, and the king answered and said, "Don't let this dream or interpretation alarm you." So Belteshazzar answered and said, "My lord, may the dream be for those who hate you and its interpretation for your enemies. The tree you saw, which grew up and became strong, so that its top reached to the heaven, and it's visible to the end of the whole earth, whose leaves were beautiful, its fruit abundant, and which good for all, and under the beasts of the field found shade and branches of the birds of the heaven, it's you, O king, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown to reaches the heavens, your dominion to the ends of the earth. And because the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, 'Chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump and its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, in the tender grass of the field, and let him be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field, 7 periods of time pass over him.'" And then he gives the interpretation that this tree being destroyed is your kingdom because of your pride. And sure enough, regardless of all the help that Daniel is trying to give him, like humble yourself before the Lord, humble yourself, Nebuchadnezzar refuses to do it. One day he's out on his balcony, he looks up and he says, "Look what all my hands have done." And in that moment, he loses everything. His whole kingdom is stripped away and he's made to act like a beast for 7 years, I believe. Okay. Finally, he is restored, whatever it looks like for him to go from that and then become humble and acknowledge it. And this could well be the whole theme of Daniel, but this is what he says at the end. So look at verse 34. Daniel chapter 4, verses 34. "At the end of days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say to him, 'What have you done?'" All right, so right there is a picture of what the main themes of Daniel are going to be. The people are in exile. What's going to be their hope? What's actually going to sustain them when everything around them is pressing down? The answer is, this is not a surprise to God. God actually is as sovereign as you can imagine. All right? He is actually in control, not just of only of the future of Israel, but he is actually in control of all the nations of the earth. Nothing escapes him. Okay, and this is one of the benefits. You can hear that from me. We affirm that as a church. But one of the benefits of apocalyptic literature is that it comes to you in a different way, and it kind of slaps you across the face in a way you weren't expecting coming. So when we get to the visions, this same theme is what's propelling everything that Daniel is relying on. There is nothing the Lord is not fully in control of. And so that's the reason that he can give out a judgment on Babylon. Okay, go to the next chapter. Belshazzar is the last king of the Babylon Empire. And he's hosting a feast. He's got goblets from Jerusalem actually out. He's getting drunk with all of his officials, and he's surprised when a hand appears and starts writing on the wall. And everyone is terrified because they have no idea what it means. And so Daniel comes and he gives the interpretation. Look in verse 13. So Daniel was brought in before the king. The king says to Daniel, "You're that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah. I've heard that you have the spirit of God, of the gods in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they couldn't show the interpretation of the matter." So skip down. This is how Daniel responds in verse 17. "Let your gifts be for yourself. Give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read you the writing and make known to the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship, greatness, glory, and majesty. Because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, languages trembled before and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed. Whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up. And whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up," and now he repeats what happened in chapter 4. So skip down to verse 22. "And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all of this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, your concubines, have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored." So can you hear that Daniel is essentially repeating the prayer that Nebuchadnezzar had made at the end of last chapter? Now the judgment. "Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing is inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed: Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parson. And this is the interpretation of the matter: Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians." Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed in purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck. Proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom of God, being about 62 years old. Okay? So right here in the middle of the book are judgments that are brought against foreign kings because of their pride against the Most High. Now, this is Daniel, in writing this, for whatever reason, only uses the name Yahweh once. For the most, he just repeats probably the way, for the most, the Babylonians were speaking. But here in the middle is judgment against those who would put themselves up against the Most High. Okay. Now, as you begin to move outward, you can see that is supposed to be the core of what strengthens the people of God for the kind of bravery that you begin to see in the chapters moving outward. So when you move to, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego standing in the fiery furnace, it's this kind of truth that propels them. Doesn't matter what you say about your everybody bowing down. It only matters what God says. Or, you know, Daniel himself and interpreting the dream with Nebuchadnezzar, or Daniel at the end of his life with Darius and, you know, being thrown to the lions. Daniel's going to go about his regular life, bowing down, praying, regardless of what any king says, because he knows that the hand of history is on his side. Okay? So, I mean, just before we get into the visions, where that comes is that there are frequent times, even in the New Testament letters, where the whole point, like Romans 13, 1 Thessalonians 5, 2 Thessalonians 2, where the whole reminder is the end of time is near. We're already living in the last days. You know what's next in salvation history. It's the return of Jesus Christ. Therefore, pray, conduct your lives with holiness. Knowing the end is what actually propels all sorts of different ways that we begin to interact and live in the world now. All right? Daniel knows this. He's going to get visions even further down the line from where he's at. But it's that knowledge of what's to come. We were even talking about this yesterday in our Exploring Crosspoint class. Someone had raised the issue of, okay, if God knows all the things that are happening, why pray? The flip side is actually what happens when you actually know what's coming. Why would you not, especially when it's glorious for all of God's people, why would you not be praying knowing that it hastens the day? How does that not stir in you an even greater fervor to pray? I mean, it works actually the exact opposite way when the biblical writers are bringing it out. All right, so let's go to Daniel 7. Okay, Daniel 7 is much like Daniel 2. There's a vision about four kingdoms. In Daniel 2, it was this giant statue, head of gold, chest of silver, and on down, describing four kingdoms. And now here, there's another vision, whether Daniel's meditating on that, where this comes to him, or he is struck with something very like it. But let's read the vision, and then the famous part, which Jesus picks up himself. In the first year of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, so we're at the very end of the Babylonian Empire again, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. And Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. All right. Israelites don't typically like the sea. It's a place of chaos. It's a place they're very much in the land. So this is already a terrifying kind of vision. And the four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, the second one like a bear, raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, arise, devour much flesh. After this, I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. This one's not described like any other animal, just a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped out what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and the mouth speaking great things. Now, we're told in a little bit, it's not just speaking great things, it's boasting. So we're back at, let's see. Okay, so verse 11 kind of fills in more of those words. I looked, and because of the sound of the great words of the horn was speaking, and I looked, the beast was killed, its body is destroyed, given over to be burned with fire, as well as the rest of the beasts. So he's boasting. This little horn is boasting in all that he's saying. I have conquered. I have overcome everything else. All right. Now, Daniel, for his part, really doesn't care at all about the beast. It's this great horn that somehow is bothering him so much. And so all of a sudden, it's like he's able to do a split screen. And he's watching the little horn on one side just boast and make all sorts of proclamations about how incredible my kingdom is and those kinds of things. While on the other hand, suddenly this vision of verse 9 comes onto the other side of the screen. So picture that. So now he's watching as something else is happening now on the other side of the screen. Verse 9, as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow. The hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning with fire. a stream of fire issued and came from before him, and 1,000 served him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him, and the court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. So all of these things that are terrifying Daniel, and now this is happening on the other side. Okay, and now, and so this is still happening over here. He's watching as the beasts are being destroyed. The great horn is taken down. And now this continues to happen in verse 13 on the other screen. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is one that shall not be destroyed. So there's the comparison right there. There are kingdoms of this world, and there's what happens in heaven. Okay? Daniel's getting behind the scenes look at that. Now, we know Jesus picks up this Son of Man language. When he's standing before Pontius Pilate and he's getting questioned, he says, you'll see one like a son of man coming in the clouds. Most likely, almost all the times, I mean, we sing some songs, right? Son of God and son of, like, crowned with many crowns, son of God, son of man. And sometimes you begin to think, okay, talking about his divinity, talking about his humanity. But son of man is a divine term. When Jesus is putting that to himself, that's enough for blasphemy in itself. So, and the reason is because only Yahweh comes on the clouds. That's the picture that Isaiah paints in Isaiah 20, verse 1, I believe. Yahweh comes on the clouds to bring his judgment. This is how Yahweh descends a thing. So already, though we have a man of some kind who's taking up these responsibilities, he is somehow also divine. And he's, of course, not just, this is how he's able to stand in the Ancient of Days presence. But he's handed over the kingdom. But not only is he divine, and not only is he a man, but it also says in some way, he also then represents all of these other people, all of the saints. So look down with me. Listen to the interpretation that Daniel gives here. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. So he approaches one who stood there, and he asks him the truth concerning all this. And he tells Daniel the interpretation. Verse 17. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever. Now, just a few verses earlier in verse 14, who was the one who receives the kingdom? It's the Son of Man, right? But now, just a few verses later, now it's being told it's actually the saints of the Most High who are receiving it. And then go to the end, look at verse 27. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion shall serve and obey him. So you have this godlike figure who's also man, who can also then incorporate what it is to include all of the saints within himself. This becomes the same kind of way that when you read through Isaiah and you read through what the servant of the Lord does through those kind of, like, Isaiah 42 to 54, as you begin to read that and you say, okay, Yahweh keeps promising he's going to send the servant of the Lord to do these kinds of things that are only a person can do, but at the same time, it seems like he's sending an entire nation that's going to be, that they're going to receive, the servant of the Lord is going to receive things as a whole bunch of people. How can this be? So Daniel is picking up on the same kind of thing. And of course, for us, then we pick up the language, right? It's the saints who are actually going to reign with Christ. Can you see how the New Testament then begins to pick up on the same themes and can begin to say, okay, why is it that you shouldn't take lawsuits with other believers and go outside to the courts? Why is it? Well, 1 Corinthians tells us it's because someday the saints are going to make judgments on angels. They're in such positions that they're going to make judgments on angels. So if that's your destiny, if that's the saints' destiny, how are you going to spend your time with little quarrels and fights here within the body? That's not what your destiny is for. That kind of, you will be exalted because you are in the Son of Man. So Daniel's already getting a glimpse of this. Kingdoms being put aside and the Son of Man being put now in this position, which gives him in exile a promise again of everything, every detail, all of these other kingdoms belong very much in the destiny of the Lord. All of their fate is already taken care of. There is no reason to worry about that. Okay. Chapter 8 now picks up on two of the kingdoms with ridiculous detail. It begins to spell out all of these details about first, the Medes and the Persian. So there's this giant ram with two horns. One horn's kind of longer than the other, though, because one represents the Persians and one represents the Medes. And he is the king until there's this little goat that shows up with his small little horn and is fast as lightning and sweeps everything away. Destroys all the other. Just wipes the ram completely off the map, which is representing. I mean, he tells us this is the kingdom of the Greeks. The interpretation is given. This is the Greeks. This is Alexander the Great in the swiftness of which he wipes everything and puts it under his own kingdom. And then all of a sudden, that horn's broken off way too early. It says Alexander, who dies so early in life, in his early 30s, and four horns grow in its place, which is exactly what happened to the Greek Empire. It was split among four different generals. One of those, the Seleucids, eventually, through time, conquers a big chunk of the area of Palestine and some other places. And it's there in 173 through 167 that Daniel gets this horrific picture of the most beloved city being torn to shreds. One of the reasons Daniel is so terrified at his visions is because he's watching his people being just destroyed. And we can go read the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, and you can read what Antiochus the 4th Epiphanes actually did to Jerusalem. We mentioned him in the when we were doing the Olivet sermons, because the abomination of desolation, of walking into the temple and just desecrating it and just putting whatever he wanted to, I mean, right in the Holy of Holies and just mocking the Jews for their faith. In fact, I think it's in 2 Maccabees where it says his goal in life was to wipe out our religion, was to wipe out our belief in God. So that's even the Israelites' interpretation of the events that are happening. So that is the reason why Daniel is so terrified at first of these visions. So now, that's a quick summary of chapter 8. What that sparks into is he's now seen two of the visions and the map unfolded even closer of them. Okay, what do I do? Well, chapter 9 is like this perfect little break in the middle, where Daniel begins to pray. All right, so flip over to chapter 9. Daniel is reading Jeremiah 25 and Jeremiah 29. And he's reading them, and he suddenly comes to the realization while meditating on them that from when he left to about the time that he's in now, because it tells us in the first year of Darius, so we're in the Medes and the Persians kingdom now, that the return from exile must be soon. Jeremiah said it was 70 years. And Jeremiah 29 actually says, not after the 70 years, you will call upon me and I will answer. So Daniel makes the obvious connection. I better get to praying. And so from verse 3, he turns his face to the Lord, seeking him by prayer and pleas for mercy with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. And he prays to the Lord and he confesses all of the reasons why they as a people have been put into exile. All of their sins, all of their constant obstinance, all of their faithlessness. And so he's confessing these things and he's praying. And as he finishes, he receives this vision. While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin, the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my plea before the Lord, my God, for the holy hill of my God. I assume that's for Jerusalem. While I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at first, came to me in swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice, and he made me understand. Daniel, I have now come out to give you insight and understanding. At the beginning of your pleas for mercy, a word went out, and I have come to tell you, you are greatly loved. Therefore, consider and understand this. 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish the transgression and to put an end to sin, to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, and to anoint a most holy place. Know, therefore, and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. Then for 62 weeks it shall be built again with squares and a moat, but in troubled times. After the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off. After the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. And then the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood. And to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. And he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week and for half of the week. And he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall come one who makes desolate until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. What? What did I just see? Okay. Now, the 70 weeks in what's happening is by far one of the most controversial passages of what's happening. My take, which could just be simply because of the guy who instructed me at seminary, is that the same guy in verse 26 and 27 is this anointed one who's talking about Jesus. He's coming to do exactly what was promised in verse 24, to bring an end to sin, to punish iniquities, to do all of that. There's a covenant that's going to be cut with him. So in Daniel's mind, there is a return from exile and there is a spiritual return from exile. And I think Isaiah talks the same way. So that when we look at things, the people need to come out of Babylon, and then we need to get the Babylon out of the people. And so this anointed one is coming, and he's going to bring these things to pass. He's going to bring a covenant that's different from what was before. And so Daniel is seeing something that will finally begin to, he's looking now into the future and being able to see something that is different from what all has come before. And this begins to give him the same kind of confidence of what's happening. So then chapters 10 through 12 are one long, at first you just see what Daniel's prayer life is like. And let me just finish with this, especially Daniel 10. Daniel is stopped in the middle of his prayers because an angel comes to him and he lets him know, you've been praying for 3 weeks. I, an angel, have been fighting a spiritual warfare trying to get to you in the answer to your prayers. and you see this cosmic battle that it's been all kind of behind the scenes, even in Daniel and other places, that's been happening this whole time. And it's Daniel's fasting and his prayer that actually brings to pass the things that he has been praying about. And so just as a word for us, some people, you can read the book of Ephesians in this exact same kind of mindset. In the beginning, in chapter one, we're supposed to be there's this Jesus has been ascended and everything is being put under his feet. Then you can see in chapter three that the church is being manifold. The whole wisdom of God is being manifested before all the rulers in the heavenly places. And then chapter six, what are we called to do? To put on the armor of God, because our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against all of those principalities. That kind of spiritual warfare dimension is then happening all in the background of Daniel and for us as well. All right, so let's stop there and let's get ready for worship. Feel free to come up if you got any questions. There's probably none on Daniel. And we'll get ready for worship.